Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. On this Monday morning in Florissant, I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and very, very grateful for you taking time out of your busy life to join me on the program this morning. Well, we might be out of the deep freeze here in Florissant where I live. It has been so cold that just this past weekend when I let my dog out, and my dog has lots of fur. She's a border collie. She's about 50 pounds or more. And she wasn't outside maybe 30 seconds till she started barking and yelping and running in like a dog scared to death. It was that bitter cold, like 4 degrees outside. But I think we're out of the deep freeze, at least for a few days this week, and thankfully we can start warming up. Well, today on the Cross in the Desert, I want to talk about a subject that is vital for our existence, and it's the subject of truth, because truth is what is reality. It's saying exactly the way things are. We're going to talk about this very important subject from a philosophical and theological construct. We're going to talk about it because we have a problem in our culture today. It's called truth decay, if you will, and it's something that I think we need to begin this new year thinking very seriously about, because like with prayer, it's like breathing, you can't do without it. So with truth, you can't live without the truth of God, the truth of God's word. Morally speaking, theologically and philosophically speaking, it is absolutely necessary to have the truth. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, but what I want to talk about right now is something that has happened just over the weekend in Iran. And it is big news. Former Iranian President Hashimi Rafsanjani, who died Sunday, aged 82, he was a former president of Iran. He was linked in the latter years of his life as a reformer, including President Hassan Rouhani. He was very much opposed to him. That was during his latter life. But during his long career, In Iran, Rafsanjani was associated with some of the regime's most controversial actions, including mass casualty terror attacks and the assassination of exiled dissidents. Iranian media reported that Rafsanjani died in Tehran's Shahada Hospital after a heart attack. Rouhani was seen visiting the hospital shortly before the news broke. Rafsanjani played an outsized political and religious role in the life of the Islamic Republic, serving as president from 1989 to 1997, but also heading two of the regime's most important institutions. They are the Assembly of Experts, which is an 88-member body of top religious scholars, which nominates the supreme leader. And he also served in the Expediency Council, a body that advises the supreme leader. Now, back in 2005, he tried to return to the presidency, but of course, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the hardliner, won that election, and Rafsanjani became one of Ahmadinejad's sharpest critics. Now, he kind of played a pragmatist, a moderate, over his last years. He backed reformers in elections last February for parliament and assembly. Now, one of the groups that is so glad that Rafsanjani has passed and died is the National Council of Resistance of Iran, Miriam Rajavi. She sees this as his death as the collapse of the two pillars and the key to the equilibrium of the religious fascism ruling Iran. And he has played a decisive role in those areas. She believes the regime will lose its internal and external equilibrium, and that will bring an overthrow of the clerical regime with the death of Rafsanjani. Now, over his 38-year career in the Iranian Revolution, he played a critical role in suppression at home and export of terrorism abroad, as well as the desire to acquire nuclear weapons. He had, as I mentioned, did a lot of assassinations of dissidents in exile. In 2006, Rafsanjani was implicated by Argentinian investigators in one of the deadliest instances of Iranian terrorism abroad, the 1994 suicide truck bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, in which 85 people were killed. The investigators accused Iran of instructing its Lebanese proxy, Hezbollah, to carry out the bombing, and they issued arrest warrants for Rafsanjani, seven other senior Iranians, and a Lebanese national Hezbollah terrorist chief. So this man had a jaded career in that he was involved in terrorist attacks, as I just mentioned, the one there. And he was also accused of ordering, while president of Iran, the killing of prominent dissidents abroad. And that included the assassination in 1992 of four Iranian Kurdish dissidents in Berlin. They were in a restaurant and when they were assassinated. So this man has had a very important career in the Islamic Republic of Iran with what he has accomplished. And we will wait and see exactly what this means, because this is the year that Rouhani will run again for president in Iran, and we're going to see how the implications or the consequences of Rafsanjani being dead now, how this will play out in the politics of Iran and its future. And as Miriam Rajavi said, she believes this will be the catalyst for a future overthrow of this regime. Let's hope that actually happens. So the latest news there in Iran is Rafsanjani. I also want to mention that Arash has been sent to a qualified good medical hospital where he is finally receiving treatment after ending his hunger strike. I think it's been about almost 6 days ago. And so that is good news for Arash, that he will receive the kind of quality medical care so that he can now get back on his feet. And so it's good to know that, and that is the latest news in Iran. What I want to talk to us about today on The Cross in the Desert is about a subject that all of us, especially you and me, need to understand more about. And it is the subject of truth. And what do I mean when I say truth? Let's define truth. It's used to mean being in accord with fact or reality. It is talking about saying it like it is. Truth is, this is reality. And it's the opposite of falsehood. Of course, something is either true or false. But what I want us to do is really talk about this subject, first of all, from a philosophical standpoint. And so this is Norman Geisler on the 1 Minute Apologist answering the question as to what is truth. Let's listen.
Welcome to the 1 Minute Apologist.
1 Minute Apologist.
We interview the world's leading apologists to provide credible answers to curious questions.
The famous question, what is truth?
Yes, Pilate. I'm not Jesus. It's ironic that the truth was standing before him. He didn't recognize it, but truth is what corresponds to reality. Truth is telling it like it is. Truth is what matches its object. If I say I have a red shirt on, it's true because, in fact, there is a red shirt there that I can point to. Truth is telling it like it is. If you don't tell it like it is, it's an error. If you do tell it like it is, it's true. How do we know that's a definition of truth? Because not only is that what philosophers have discovered the nature of truth is, but you can't deny it without affirming it. If you say, well, I don't think truth is telling it like it is, I'd say, was that telling it like it is? You just told it like it is, saying you don't need to tell it like it is. You can't avoid philosophy being a correspondence view of truth.
That is Dr. Norman Geisler speaking about a definition, an easy definition that you can remember that actually says this is what truth is. Well, philosophers, sages, and theologians have debated down the centuries as to what is truth. If you ask a college student on any given campus what is truth, you are bound to receive answers such as everyone has an opinion or preference, to each his own, and whatever I decide is right. Well, 2,000 years ago, standing before Pontius Pilate, Jesus didn't give an opinion or quote from any of the philosophers. Instead, he made a startling affirmation as to what truth was. He looked Pilate directly in the eyes and declared, "I was born and came into the world to testify to the truth. All who love the truth recognize that what I say is truth." Well, Pilate couldn't believe his ears. Who does this man think he is? Instead of bowing down in awe and worship, Pilate mocked Christ's declaration and scoffingly replied to his affirmation. He goes, "Well, what is truth?" Our culture has carried on this same mocking and ridicule about the nature of truth. Truth is irrelevant. Only what I decide is right is the mood of our culture. Casting aside all respect and ridiculing and rebelling against any recognized authority, our culture has abandoned any standard of righteousness and replaced it with their own whims and wishes. Truth has been reduced to preference and whatever feels right at the moment. No wonder there is violence in school, kids killing other kids, kids murdering their parents. When truth is abandoned, we lose our moral sensitivity and begin calling what is evil good. The sad lament in the book of Judges was that, quote, everyone was doing what was right in the sight of their own eyes. As a result, there was moral and spiritual decay, resulting in the judgment of God. Earlier in John's gospel, Jesus declared, "I am the way and the truth." 3 chapters later, Jesus prayed to his Father to teach them your word, which is truth. The Bible presents God as a God of truth and integrity. Unfortunately, most of our culture has the cynicism and unbelief of Pilate, mockingly saying, "Well, what is truth?" Well, but do you care about what is true and false? Jesus says that if you love the truth, then you will believe and obey him. Our culture is suffering from, quote, truth decay. The only remedy is proclaiming Christ is the truth and affirming that his word is the final authority. If you want a life of integrity that will stand against the storms of life when all other foundations are crumbling, then come to Christ and be safe and secure in the truth. So important. This is the attitude of our culture, the way that Pilate answered Jesus when he declared that all who listen to my voice will listen to the truth. Pilate says, huh, what is truth? But that's the mood of our culture. And the opposite of truth and absolute truth is something called relativism. Well, what is relativism? Once again, here's Dr. Norman Geisler defining terms for us on the 1 Minute Apologist.
Welcome to the 1 Minute Apologist.
1 Minute Apologist.
If you had 1 minute
apologia
to be able to unpack for the audience,
we interview the world's leading apologists to provide credible answers to curious questions.
Welcome to the 1 Minute Apologist. My name is Bobby Conway, and I am here with Dr. Norman Geisler. Good to be with you, Dr. Geisler.
It's nice to be here, and it's nice to be anywhere at my age.
Hey, I think it's nice to be anywhere at my age as well. We're living in a time that is known as relativism, where people go around saying it doesn't matter what you believe and all beliefs are equal. We know that the ancient question that Jesus was asked by Pilate was, what is truth? How could you respond to somebody today who's a relativist by telling them what truth is?
Well, I'd say to them, truth is telling it like it is. That's a common everyday expression today. Truth is what corresponds to the facts. It's a fact that I'm here discussing this with you, so it's a true statement to say that I am. It's a fact that I exist, so it's a true statement to say that I am. So there's nothing tricky about truth. It's what corresponds to the facts, what tells it like it is, what matches its object. If I say I'm sitting in a chair, matches the object, and falsehood is just the opposite. I'm not somewhere else. I'm right here today. You know, the square, the earth is not square. It's round. So truth is telling it like it is. Falsehood is the opposite of true, not telling it like it is. So there's nothing tricky about truth. What's tricky is that people think that you can apply this in a subjective way, and they say, well, it's true for you, but not for me. I say, well, it's not true for you. 2 plus 2 is true for both of us, you know. Yeah. And 3 times 3 is 9 is true for both of us. The law of non-contradiction is true for everybody. It's not just true somewhere. No matter what culture, what language you're in, it's still true. It's objectively true. If they say, well, I don't believe in objective truth, I say, is that objectively true? You know, or I don't believe in absolute truth, I say, is that absolutely true? You know, they're self-defeating statements. Well, I'm skeptical about everything. Well, you're skeptical about that? Are you really skeptical about everything? So everybody really in actual practice, in real life, everybody believes in absolute truth. You go into court and you say, I swear to tell the expedient, the whole expedient, and nothing but the expedient, so help me future experience. The judge won't buy it, and the jury won't buy it.
Well, once again, Dr. Norman Geisler, helping us to understand these terms like relativism, and you know you can't live by that claim. And one of the most popular claims that comes out of the mood of our culture when they reject absolute truth and truth becomes just a personal whim, preference, and not an objective reality like 1 plus 1 equals 2, they have a statement that used to drive me crazy, and it's called, well, but that's true for you, but not for me. Have you ever been in a conversation where you're talking about the Bible, maybe the claims of Christ, and someone who has no love for authority, no love for the standards of life, but he's a relativist, if you will, he will say to you, well, but that's true for you, but it's not true for me. And you feel like, what do I say in response to? Well, what's going on here, first of all? What's actually going on here is the person that's making that statement has said, in essence, I don't want anything to do with authority. I don't want anything to do with your beliefs. I want to live my life the way that I choose to live. And so the easy way for me to answer your claims and what you're trying to instruct me to believe is it's true for you, but not for me. I want us to unpack that statement that seems to be a conversation stopper. And I want you to hear from Ravi Zacharias Ministries in Canada, a good response to this rejection of absolute truth. Let's listen.
After a recent event at which I was speaking, a student came up to me and said, "I wonder if I can pick your brains. I'm having trouble with a friend of mine at school." "What's the problem?" I said. "Well," she said, "my friend is a moral relativist. Whatever the subject, whatever we're talking about, whether it's rape or murder or human trafficking, doesn't matter what example you use, my friend always says she doesn't believe in moral absolutes. Everything is relative. That may be true for you," she said, "but it's not true for me." "How should I respond to my friend?" the student asked me. I thought about it for a moment, and then I said to her, "Next time you're talking to her friend and she denies that she believes in any form of moral absolute, any moral truth, just reach over and steal her iPhone, blatantly take her mobile phone. I suspect that very quickly your friend will start protesting, 'Give me back my phone.' And then you say to your friend, 'But I didn't think you believed in moral absolutes.'" In other words, the idea that something might be true for you but not true for me sounds lovely, but when you apply it in the real world, it breaks down. Yet nevertheless, we hear it all the time. We live in a very postmodern, relativistic age. Why is that? Well, I think many people in our culture have bought into the idea that truth claims, especially in the realm of morality and ethics, restrict us. If there is moral truth, we would be restricted and we want to be free. And so therefore we reject morality. We reject truth. We say true for you, not true for me. The problem is the absence of truth, the absence of restrictions doesn't equal freedom, it equals anarchy. Just think about something like a game of hockey for a moment. If you removed every rule from the hockey match and just let the players do entirely what they wanted, would you have freedom? No, you'd have utter anarchy. You'd have no game at all. The game couldn't be played. We need structure for life, society, things to function. Remove rules, remove all regulations, deny truth, you have not freedom, but anarchy. One last thought though. Imagine that you were to go and stand on the highest building in downtown Toronto, where I live, the CN Tower. And you stand on the edge of that building and you say to yourself, "I don't believe in absolutes. I don't believe in the law of gravity. That might be true for you, not true for me." And after that tremendous announcement, you leap off the building. What is going to happen? Well, you're going to fall to the ground and become a small pizza-shaped stain at the bottom. You have tried to break the law of gravity and it's ended up breaking you. The same is true of God's moral law, I believe. If you try to break it, if you try to break that framework that God has put into society, you don't end up with freedom. You end up breaking yourselves, hurting other people, breaking society. And that, says the Bible, is what has basically gone wrong with us. And that's why God had to take the radical step of sending his son, Jesus Christ, who claimed to be truth itself, who came to die on the cross to deal with that brokenness and that mess and that alienation that we've caused for ourselves, offer us the chance of new life and new creation and put us back into relationship with him. And that, I believe, is true for me, it's true for you, it's true for each one of us.
Well, I thought that was an excellent explanation with some good illustrations to back up why this statement, true for you but not for me, is absurd, it's self-defeating, and you really can't live it out in real life. As he so well explains, you're going to stand on the edge of, let's say, a cliff and say, "I don't believe in the law of gravity. That's true for you but not for me." Well, you're soon going to die. So you really can't practically live it out. What I want to do is I want to do a transition here and more explain to you from a biblical standpoint the idea of truth. And we've been talking about how Pilate mocked Jesus saying, "What is truth?" And we know that truth is that which conforms to fact or reality. Well, let's talk about what the Bible teaches about truth. The Bible says that God the Father is the God of truth, that Jesus Christ is full of grace and truth. In fact, he is the truth. The Holy Spirit is the Spirit of truth. Paul calls Scripture the Word of truth. Jesus prayed, "Your word is truth." Everything about God is true. God always tells it like it is. Well, you ask the question, how valuable is the truth? Well, it's worth more than gold, yes, than much fine gold, Psalm 19, verse 10 says. John Calvin, the great reformer, said, "Nothing is deemed more precious by God than truth. No one can be saved without the truth, nor can anyone be sanctified or strengthened without it." We find out from the Bible that truth is divine. What that means is ultimately all truth is God's truth. Truth is from above. It is not of this world. It is not what the crowd speculates something to be. Truth is not determined by opinion polls, nor is truth discovered by public surveys. It is not grandfathered in by human tradition. Truth can only be discovered by divine revelation. God is the one source and sole author of truth. Sin, here's an example. Sin is whatever God says it is. Judgment is whatever God says it is. Salvation is what God says it is. Heaven and hell are what God says they are. It matters not what man says, but simply what God says. One word of what God says is worth more than 10,000 libraries of what man says. Let God be found true, though every man be found a liar, Romans chapter 3, verse 4. So we discovered first that truth is divine. Second, truth is absolute. And here is where the culture has the most antagonism against, the most rejection of, and that is absolute truth. Well, without God, there cannot be any absolutes. Without absolutes, there can be no objective universal truths. Without absolutes, truth becomes subjective, relative, and pragmatic. Without absolutes, truth gives way to mere personal or cultural preferences. But to the contrary, all truth is absolute because God is absolute truth. That means that only what is of truth is true. Everything contrary to the truth is a lie. Truth is exclusive, not inclusive. Truth is discriminating as it excludes whatever is not true. Truth is incompatible with and is intolerant of all error. If all truth is God's truth, then all untruths are the devil's lies. The issue in our day is whether there is absolute truth that is true for everyone, no matter who they are, where they live, or what they do. Many people say that truth is whatever they want it to be. They claim that what you believe is true for you, as I've been saying, and what I believe is true for me, even when the two are worlds apart. Something cannot be both true and not true. In such a worldview of self-deception, truth is no longer objective. All truth is universally true. Now, the third thing I want to say about this is that truth is singular. And bear with me on this. This is important. That is to say, truth is a single entity. Truth does not exist in bits and pieces of unrelated ideas or disconnected data. So we know that truth is singular in that sense. Truth, is consistent with itself. Fourth, and here's an important part, truth is objective. That means that truth is not subjective, meaning truth is not whatever I feel it to be, whatever I want it to be, whatever I prefer it to be. Truth is something that is objectively true. It is not discovered by my personal feelings. It's not determined by private intuitions. Truth is propositional. It is conveyed in narrowly defined words that have rational definitions. Words mean something in regard to the truth. Therefore, truth is black and white. It is definitive and conclusive. And because truth is objective, it is unbiased. It speaks to all people in all places at all time. Truth never speaks out of both sides of its mouth. It never caters to the crowd. It never says one thing to one person and something else to another. Truth addresses all people alike as it's discovered by them. Truth is immutable. It means it doesn't change. God doesn't change. Neither does his truth. What is true today will be still true tomorrow. Truth is the same yesterday, today, and forever. As the psalmist declares, "Forever, O Lord, your word is settled in heaven." Psalm 119, verse 89. Isaiah 40, chapter 40, verse 8 says, "The grass withers, the flowers fade, but the word of God abides forever." The world changes, kingdoms rise and fall, but truth remains unchanging. So that means truth is permanent, it's fixed, it's established. It is unflexible, unvarying, constant, lasting, enduring, timeless, changing. I think you get the point. So truth is immutable. It doesn't change. Truth is authoritative. Now, this is very important. It speaks with the supreme authority of God himself. Truth roars with the sound of many waters, drowning out every other voice. Jesus says, "You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Very clear what Jesus says. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. And, of course, the famous teaching and declaration by Jesus, who says, "I am the way and the truth and the life." So it tells us how to worship. It tells us how to walk. It tells us how to follow Christ. It is the final judge of every life. All people are measured by the truth. Every life is weighed in the balances by the truth. Every destiny is marked by the truth. And so the truth will have the final say in every life. And I want to thank Ligonier Ministries by Steve Lawson, who wrote this article several years ago. This is an excellent article. Stephen Lawson is the president and founder of One Passion Ministries, and this was featured on a Ligonier website. So I highly recommend that you go to your browser and type in "What is Truth? Ligonier Ministries." This is a great article that will steer you in the right direction, since we're talking about the subject of truth today. Well, we have dealt with truth, its definition, and some of the objections to truth. And what I want to do now is go to the words of Jesus himself and talk to you about what Jesus meant when he says, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Well, the truth will set you free, that's a common saying in academic circles that want to promote academic freedom and the power of learning. So many universities have this statement emblazoned on a sign near the entrance of the building. But "the truth will set you free" didn't come in a classroom or a university. It originated with Jesus. I want you to hear about what Jesus meant when he said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Well, Jesus had just finished a speech at the temple where he was delineating the differences between him and himself and his listeners. He said, "You are from below, I'm from above. You are of this world. I am not of this world. I told you that you would die in your sins. If you do not believe that I am he, you will indeed die in your sins." John chapter 8, verses 23 to 24. The result of Jesus' message was that even as he spoke, believed in him. Then in verse 31, Jesus begins to speak just to those who had believed in him. Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you're really my disciples." So what that means is true discipleship is much more than intellectual dissent. And then he says to them very clearly, "Then you will know the truth." What does that mean? He's referring to those who are true disciples of Jesus. True disciples will know the truth. It's more than just intellectual dissent. And Jesus continues by saying, "And you will know the truth. Truth will set you free." Well, what's going on here with this statement? "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Well, Jesus says, if you're truly my disciples, you're going to follow me. You're going to abide in me. You're going to do what I say if you're truly my disciples. And then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Well, what's going on here? At that time in history, the Jews were under the rule of the Roman government. Even though Rome gave them an exceptional amount of autonomy, they were keenly aware of the Roman presence around them in the form of soldiers, governors, and appointed kings. So when Jesus said the truth would set them free, he was not talking about political freedom. Jesus provides the best commentary on his own statement in verse 34. If you go down further in what Jesus says, "I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave of sin." So being a slave to sin is the ultimate bondage, not the bondage to Rome or political authority. The freedom that Jesus is talking about here is a spiritual freedom from the bondage of sin. That means a release from the lifestyle of habitual lawlessness. He continues with an analogy so that you will get the point. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. Now, the people would have understood Jesus to mean that they were not members of God's family despite their biological relationship to Abraham because they were slaves to sin. If they were to become disciples of Jesus, they would know the truth of their condition, and the truth about Christ and Jesus would set them free. In other words, believers would be freed from their bondage and brought into the family of God. We know that Jesus is the truth. Knowing the truth will set one at liberty. That is freedom from sin, freedom from condemnation, and freedom from death. We know the mission of Jesus was to come and proclaim liberty or freedom to those held in bondage. And so we see that Jesus sets the captives free. And I thought this was very important that we understand what Jesus is saying. You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. He's not talking about some autonomous freedom or freedom from political or government authority. He's talking about freedom from our sinful condition. When we realize the truth of who we are and who Jesus is, that truth will set us free. And so as we look into the Bible about our subject today, what we've learned so far is God is the God of truth, and that Jesus stood before Pilate proclaiming truth, and that the reaction to the God of truth is that our culture immediately retreats in terror. Immediately they will stand against the truth. They will rebel against the truth. You see, because human nature wants a freedom apart from God. Human nature wants to be the captain of their own salvation. We don't want religious claims to keep us in bondage. We don't want a God to tell us what to do. We don't want authority to rule our life. So we become little gods with our own version of the truth and our own version of freedom. It's very sad, but that is the problem of truth decay today in our culture. What I want to do right now, I want to take us to one of the great authors of all time, and that is C.S. Lewis, the man who wrote the Chronicles of Narnia for children and adults, who wrote the definitive book Mere Christianity. At one time, C.S. Lewis was an atheist, and he was searching. He had some good friends. And one of his best friends at that time was an author of The Lord of the Rings, J.R. Tolkien. And Lewis had returned from the war and was teaching now in academic circles. And he had a conversation with J.R. Tolkien. Conversation about what they had was so instrumental in leading C.S. Lewis to Jesus Christ to become a Christian. This conversation is talked about so often in C.S. Lewis's books. It was the turning point in coming out of atheism to theism and becoming a Christian. And this conversation is about what is true. And I want you to hear this. It's about 8 minutes long, but it's so good. And in this conversation, J.R. Tolkien is trying to show C.S. Lewis that the worldview of atheism is not real. It doesn't match reality. And I want you to hear this very good conversation as they debate the subject of myth and what is true. Let's listen.
Including in fairy stories, which I think is rather ridiculous. After all, the magic of myths or fairy stories is not an end in itself. It exists to serve virtue and satisfy certain primordial human desires.
But myths are fiction. The stories they tell aren't true. They're lies, and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver. They're just beautiful lies. You can't seriously believe in fairy tales.
Why not? I can. In fact, I do.
But this is preposterous. How can you seriously believe a lie?
Oh, Jack, myths are not lies. In fact, they're the very opposite of a lie. Myths convey the essential truth, the primal reality of life itself.
Go on.
Well, you see, We have been duped into using the word myth as being synonymous with a lie, because we have been duped into accepting the first real lie of materialism.
And what is that?
That is the hideous claim that there is no supernatural order to the universe. The materialists have imprisoned us in a world of mere matter, of physical facts, divorced from and devoid of metaphysical truth. Well, I say that they are lying. I say that they are the ones who have come up with a false myth. Their world doesn't exist. It's merely a figment of their imagination. Well, fine. However, there's a problem. The problem is they have convinced us that it is true. They have made us believe that this is all there is. Three dimensions, five senses, four walls.
Isn't it?
Most emphatically not. Jack, the four walls of materialism are the four walls of a prison, and the materialists are our jailers. Don't you see? They've put us in a prison of four walls. They don't want us to see what's beyond those walls. They don't want us to discover what lies outside their narrow philosophy. Worse than that, they think that any attempt to escape from the prison is an act of treason.
Well, wouldn't it be an act of treason against rationality to believe otherwise?
Now, Jack, think for a moment. How can it be wrong for a prisoner to think of things that exist other than walls or jailers? Doesn't the fact that the prisoner is able to think of things outside the walls suggest that perhaps things do exist outside the walls? After all, if the prison really is all there is, how are we able to picture things that exist beyond the prison? And this is where myths come in, you see. Myths exist outside the prison. Myths allow us to escape from the prison. Or if we are not able to escape, at the very least, they allow us to catch a fleeting but oh so powerful glimpse of the beauty that lies beyond the walls.
But what is it that we're meant to be glimpsing?
Well, don't you see? The truth, Jack. Myths show us a fleeting glimpse of truth itself.
Truth. Truth. What on earth is this truth that you're talking about?
Ah. Quid est veritas. What is truth? I'm glad to see that you've entered into the spirit of the myth, Jack. You've just cast yourself into the role of Pilate.
Pilate? Oh, I see. You're able to believe in the lesser myths because we've already accepted the big one. Once you accept the big myth, the lie of Christ, it's easy to accept the smaller ones. All right, Tolas, I'll play the role of Pilate. I wash my hands of the whole nonsense.
Well, Jack, you may be able to wash your hands, but your mind is still muddied. You're not thinking clearly at all, old chap. You're acting as if myths are mere arbitrary inventions of fiction, as if we pull them out of thin air. But what you don't understand is that we make things by the law in which we are made. We create because we are created. Creativity. Imagination is God's imageness in us. We tell stories because God is a storyteller. In fact, He is the storyteller. We tell our stories with words. He tells His story with history. The facts of history are His words, and providence is His storyline.
Are you suggesting that all of history, that everything around us is all part of some divine myth?
We are all part of His story. This very conversation is part of His story.
But perhaps it isn't His story. Perhaps it's only your story. How can you know that your story the story that you believe, the Christian story, is any more real than the other story.
But don't you see, it isn't my story, it's his story. You're acting as if Christianity is one myth among many. It's not, it's the true myth. Christianity really happened. Jesus really existed, so did Pilate. And yet it is this true story that makes sense of all the other stories. It is the archetype. It is the story in which all the other stories have their source. And the story to which all the other stories point. It has everything. It has catastrophe and its opposite. What we might call eucatastrophe. It has the joy of the happy ending. The sudden joyous turn in the story that is essential to all myths. It has to a sublime degree this joy of deliverance, this evangelium, this fleeting glimpse of the real joy to which all other joys are but a distant echo.
Tell us, what did you mean by catastrophe, a new catastrophe?
Well, for example, it has the catastrophe of the fall and the eucatastrophe of the redemption. It has the catastrophe of the crucifixion and the eucatastrophe of the resurrection. It has everything man's heart desires because it is being told by the one who is the fulfillment of desire itself. It is a story that begins and ends in joy.
But just because a story brings joy, it doesn't necessarily follow that it's true. There are many joyful myths. They all seem rather flimsy to me and ring rather false.
And yet this story has the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merit.
Perhaps it's just a very well-written artifice.
This story has the supremely convincing tone of primary art, not fiction, but of creation. And to reject this leads either to darkness or to wrath. And in my own life, it has led me from darkness to light.
Astonishing. Tell us, you astonish me. You're absolutely
This is a fascinating conversation between C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings. This conversation took place shortly before C.S. Lewis became a Christian. It was this particular conversation, this wonderful providential meeting of the two as they walked along in the forest area, right by the kilns where C.S. Lewis lived. This fascinating conversation is what stirred the mind and emotions of C.S. Lewis. He objected to almost everything J.R. Tolkien said, but in the end, this story, this masterful storyteller, this story that J.R. Tolkien said that God is telling, defined C.S. Lewis's heart and life. It really fulfilled and answered a lot of questions he had at that time as an atheist. And why I wanted to share this with you is because atheists, materialists who reject the truth, have no real answers. They have no real reality in life, and they do much more than just try to find fault with the Christian story. They try to object to it, but in the end, their heart is warmed toward the truth. It's because in what J.R. Tolkien was sharing, there was so much truth as to what he said in this conversation, answering each and every one of C.S. Lewis's objections. A good friend, he stuck right in there. He didn't give up. It's because J.R. Tolkien was a master author and a very devout Christian. And he saw clearly what he was trying to help his good friend see at that time, clearly. But this is a great example of how those with a different worldview, and in the case of Lewis, it was a materialistic, atheistic worldview, they have no answers. And ultimately, the truth won out in the end. I want you to hear in our closing today of our program a song which really says it all about our subject today. This is Casting Crowns and the Voice of Truth right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Climb out of this boat and then onto the crashing waves, to step out of my comfort zone into the realm of the unknown, where Jesus is and he's holding out his hand. But the waves are calling out my name and they laugh at me, reminding me of all the times I've tried before and failed. Ways they keep on telling me time and time again, boy, you never win, you never win. But the voice of truth tells me a different story. The voice of truth says do not be afraid, and the voice of truth says this is for my glory. Just a sling and a stone, surrounded by the sound of a thousand warriors shaking in their armor, wishing they'd have had the strength to stand. But the giants calling out my name and they laughed at me, reminding me of all the times I tried before and failed. The giant keeps on telling me time and time again, boy, you never win, you never win. But the voice of truth tells me a different story. The voice of truth.
the music of Casting Crowns, Voice of Truth, which really wraps up everything I've been saying and sharing with you this morning. Jesus says, who is ever of the truth, everyone who is of the truth will listen to my voice, because Jesus is the voice of truth. It is Jesus who made the statement that really is one of my absolute favorite scriptures in the Bible, John chapter 14, verse 6. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So Jesus says, I am the way if you're lost. I am the truth if you're searching. I am the life that will change you forever and ever and ever. You see, this isn't about bondage. This is about freedom. Knowing Christ means I have a brand new life. I have a freedom to be all that God has created me to be. So it's the absolute opposite of what the world is saying, of what the secular world is saying, of what the skeptic and the unbeliever is saying. They would say that what you have is religious bondage, and I would say, no, I have a true love relationship which results in freedom, and Jesus has come to set me free. He has come to set me free from the bondage of sin. He has come to give me a new heart and a new spirit. You can know the truth today. You can know the truth. You can know what life is. You can know the meaning of life. When you come to Jesus, he will set you free from the inside out, because he has come to set all of us free, all of us who are captive and in bondage to sin. I want to thank my good guests today in the chat room, Ava and Patricia. I want to thank you so much for spending time with me today. God bless you both. I will see you very soon again on Thursday on The Cross in the Desert. Have a fantastic week.
Faithful lightning of his